And now,
the top 10 reasons to listen to Philosophy Talk.
Number 10,
never questions your intelligence.
Number 9,
you slept through philosophy in college.
Number 8,
I listen, therefore I am.
Number 7,
philosophy is the world's second oldest profession.
Number 6,
liquor is quicker, but Nietzsche is peachy.
Number 5,
two words, no midterm.
Number 4,
cures nipple itch.
Number 3,
no hemlock required.
Number 2,
Aristotle is so hot.
And the number one reason to listen to Philosophy Talk.
I thought it was car talk. It's a philosophical top 10 list.
The 200th episode of Philosophy Talk. After the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, radio that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, we're having a party. We're celebrating 200 episodes of Philosophy Talk.
We're going to compile a top 10 list to mark the occasion. This is going to be a list of the most pressing philosophical problems of the 21st century. At the end of the show, we should have at least 10.
Yeah, and we've invited some of our old friends to help us, including the ever-deep and probing Janan Ismail, author of The Situated Self, Martha Nussbaum, one of today's most prolific public intellectuals who's written and thought about all manner of philosophical topics, and a man with his finger on the pulse of everything happening in the world of philosophy. That's Brian Leiter, editor of The Future of Philosophy.
And we also want help from our listeners. Offer your suggestions for our top 10 list. You can use email or blog or the good old-fashioned telephone.
But before we get to all that, John, let's talk about what we're looking for. I mean, many of the problems of philosophy are perennial and unchanging. So doesn't that mean that the most pressing philosophical problems of the current century, of today, will be the same as the most pressing philosophical problems of the last century, of yesterday, and maybe even the day before yesterday, the century before that? What do you think?
Well, philosophy does have a long time horizon, and a lot of the problems of philosophy are not problems peculiar to this or that moment, although they may take on a different appearance from moment to moment. They're problems that confront any fully reflective person, no matter where, or more to the point, when they happen to live.
Right. I mean, I take your point. Every reflective person, every single reflective person faces questions like, what's the nature of right and wrong? What's the nature of the self? What is time? What do I owe to others? What do others owe to me? I mean, those questions just come with the turf of being a reflective human being.
Right. But the perennial questions, like who owes what to whom, take on a particular shape and significance depending on when and where they're asked. Kant didn't have to worry about who was obliged to whom in the light of the world falling apart and being screwed up by human beings, but the generation that includes your son and my many grandchildren will have to ask what's right and wrong in that context. They'll be confronting head-on the consequences of humanity's relatively recent screwing up of the Earth and its ecosystem. And that fact will have massive consequences for the way they answer the question of what they owe to whom.
Yeah, you know, this question of who owes what to whom is one that philosophers have been asking since philosophers began doing philosophy. But, you know, I think that even with our accumulated wisdom on this topic, which is considerable, I mean, it's considerable, I still doubt that we've thought up enough concepts and distinctions to arrive at a fully defensible answer to this question in the context of 21st century life that you just described.
Well, it's like what Nietzsche said. At the end of the last century. What we need is a new justice, a new watchword, and new philosophers. There's yet another world to be discovered, he said, and more than one, he added. Embark, philosophers.
He commanded, embark, philosophers. You know, and philosophers of the 21st century will need to embark on lots of new voyages of discovery, too. For example, I think that we need new philosophies about the human mind and also about the human self. That's because, you know, the mind's always been a philosophical mystery, but soon, I mean very soon, science will reveal just how the brain produces consciousness and language and rationality and emotion, and that'll be a good thing because it'll unravel all the mystery. But it also will shatter, I believe, many of our most deeply held beliefs about the nature of the self, about freedom and autonomy. It's just a bunch of neurons, and here's how it works. And philosophy will need to step in to help us think through what, if anything, can replace our cherished illusions in light of this demolition thing that science is going to do.
Well, I don't know, Ken. Between Janann Ismail and I, we've probably said all that ever needs to be said about this, but it may take the rest of the century for the rest of philosophy to catch up. But at any rate, what about our ever-increasing power to manipulate the biological fabric of our lives? That's something earlier generations of philosophers could dream about, but it didn't really confront them. Will our collective wisdom grow in proportion to that ever-increasing power? Will our power once again outstrip our wisdom?
Yeah, the power usually outstrips wisdom. That's unfortunate. But, John, you know, that means there's certainly no shortage of work for 21st century philosophers to keep them engaged. And that means there's no shortage of things for us, our listeners, and our three distinguished guests to talk about today.
And we're very eager to know what our listeners think. What are the most pressing philosophical problems you see for the 21st century? The number to call is 1-800-525-9917. I'll repeat, 1-800-525-9917.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Andy McDaniel, gets the party started by looking for philosophers on the streets. She files this report.
What philosophical issues are people pondering these days? To find out, I spent an afternoon on the UC Berkeley campus, and I asked passersby,
what would you say is the biggest philosophical issue of our day?
My thing is abortion.
Whether or not to give aid to families in need or like have it just trickle down from the wealthy.
Personal versus intellectual property.
I don't know that I'm the best person to know what that is.
A number of people I spoke to got their inspiration from the day's news.
I guess healthcare is what's the biggest agenda of the day.
The way we pass our healthcare reform really comes out of like ideological perception of the law. Whether you believe that all people should be able entitled to healthcare, or whether you believe, yes, people should be entitled to healthcare, yet they should be done in a more like capitalist way.
One thing that kind of strikes me is the idea of personalized medicine based on personal genetics. The idea of tiering by genetics versus by color or race.
Yeah, I kind of have the same problem with it because I think about like insurance companies having that kind of information and starting to like discriminate between people and like giving insurance to people based on their genetic data.
Some folks went for the big timeless questions.
I think one of the biggest ethical moral issues is freedom. It seems like today, progressively, people are losing their freedoms.
I think the biggest issue is people being closed-minded, having prejudices about another individual or another group, and letting that get in the way of either, getting to know them.
I think just the whole major political party system is a huge flaw in our society. I mean, if we're supposed to be Americans working for the common good for our country, but there's two major parties that are ripping each other apart and making things 10 times harder to get things accomplished, then I think that's putting a major halt on progression in America.
Integrity is a big deal, and it's probably what we need to focus on if we're going to get better as a whole.
I guess one of the things that's got my attention right now is the whole environmental issue versus capitalism, since it's causing some people to have a blind eye to the long-run effect on the environment and the world.
The food production issue is really big. Like, not only the distribution of it, but also like what goes into our food and how we manage that and oversee it and who's responsible for what we eat, basically.
Consumers not acknowledging that what they wear, what they use, what they buy, what they eat had to be made by a person.
Of course, as we head into the 21st century, some questions may have to remain unanswered.
Could Jesus microwave a burrito so hot that he himself could not eat it?
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Andy McDaniel.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And today we're celebrating 200 episodes of Philosophy Talk by asking you, the listeners who've made it possible for us to create 200 episodes of this lovely show, to help us compile a philosophical top 10 list for the 21st century.
What burning issues do you think philosophers in Philosophy Talk should tackle in the years ahead? Give us a call at 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. There's also a live blog entry, so you can exchange views with folks from all over the world. Go to our blog at theblog.philosophytalk.org.
And right now, we're joined by a very dear friend of Philosophy Talk. She's been on the show to talk about many things, including the strange world of quantum reality. That was one of my favorite shows. That's Janann Ismael. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of Arizona. She's a fellow at the Center for Time Studies at the University of Sydney in Australia, and author most recently of The Situated Self. Janann, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks so much, and congratulations on your 200th show.
Well, thank you, Janann. Now, we're going to temporarily crown you as Miss Nietzsche, the modern version of Nietzsche. Your job is to call forth to a new generation of philosophers whose task is to use the tools of philosophy to address the human problems of the 21st century. So I hope you're comfortable with that role. What is the top philosophical problem that you would call upon the younger generation of philosophers to solve?
Well, I think for myself, I mean, even though I've written a lot about the self and the individual, the thing that troubles me most, and I don't have a solution to it, but is the difficulty that we face as a population. I mean, we need to make collective decisions, big decisions about the planet. As a collection, I mean, our actions are now our impact on the future is now more foreseeable than it ever has been before, and our actions as a population have a kind of unprecedented impact, large-scale effects beyond our own lives with relatively foreseeable consequences, and we're just not equipped. We haven't been doing well at ensuring that the way that we act in the collective interest.
Oh, Janann, I think you're right, and I think really this is a huge problem for 21st century human beings. And, you know, it's a problem really, although, you know, ethical, moral reasoning has been the at the core of philosophical thinking for a long time, I actually don't believe that much in the past of philosophy equips us that well to solve these problems in a rational, insightful way. Do you agree or do you disagree? Do you think there are resources out there that just need to be marshaled, or do we need to think up new resources to think through this issue?
Actually, I'm not sure that it's strictly an ethical problem, and the reason is that it's not that people don't have their hearts in the right place. In a way, it's a kind of general design difficulty that has nothing to do with what are not being good people, or not even a question about agreeing what's in the collective interest, or not even a question about not knowing how to act to promote the collective interest. The thing is that we don't collectively act in the ways that each of us wants us to collectively act, because personal effectiveness and responsibility are spread too thin. So the idea is not that we have a collective goal, saving the planet. The problem is that individual actions don't by themselves promote the collective goal unless everybody else acts in the same way.
So Janann, the Chinese famously limited families to one child, and people in America and elsewhere in the West seem to think that was a huge violation of individual liberties. And then it had the untoward effect of reducing the proportion of women to men. Because of cultural factors in China. So, I mean, what do you think about those trade-offs? Do you think violating the people's right to have all the children they want is something that should be done by the states around the world?
I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, one thing is clear is that my actions by themselves don't constitute a solution, and that without a strong central governing structure that makes utility calculations in the collective interest and governs individual actions, decision theoretic rationality among the parts of a collective, whether it's individuals in the nation or whether it's nations in a kind of international international organization, under the sorts of conditions that we're facing now, will not produce actions that promote the collective interest. I absolutely agree with you that America's foundational value, the rock on which we're built, is the freedom of the individual. And I think what we need to understand right now is the nature of the problem.
Janann, I want to keep you on for a little bit longer, and I'm going to dig into this just a little bit more, okay? You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're celebrating 200 episodes of Philosophy Talk by asking you to help us compile a list of the most pressing philosophical challenges for life in the 21st century.
You know, modern life is proving full of philosophical challenges. We need to rethink our relations to the earth, to each other, the very idea of a nation, of a corporation, the idea of a free, autonomous human being. All this is being brought under pressure by science, by the reconfiguration of commerce, and by our knowledge that we're having a bad effect on the environment. Amongst all this, what are the most pressing philosophical challenges for the coming age? Join us by calling toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
The philosophy and philosophers of the future, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
The philosophical tomorrow is here, but will it be better than before? I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk. What do you see as the biggest philosophical challenges of tomorrow, of 10 years from now, of the next century, the next millennium? Tell us what you think.
The toll-free number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Or you can post a comment on our blog at theblog.philosophytalk.org. We've got Janan Ismail from the University of Arizona on the line. And Janan, I just want you to say a little bit more about this massive coordination problem that you talked about. You said a lot of different things. It seems to me that what you're suggesting, in order to do what you're saying, this global coordination, we have to rethink what a nation is, what individual rights are. I mean, because there just aren't the mechanisms in place to enable us to do this in a rational, mutually acceptable way. Are there?
No, I don't think there are. And I think, you know, one of the things that we have to understand is that just persuading people to care about the environment is not going to be an effective intervention. Again, you know, it's a problem about how to weigh individual rationality against collective rationality. And I think we're not, the ways that we make decisions individually will not sort of promote as a kind of emergent effect,
right,
the collective good.
Right, because we have a kind of, the 21st century gives us a kind of at least potential collectivity, this kind of global thing that Marx dreamed of, but it was never really a reality until now, this moment. So we really are in a unique situation.
It's not just, I think, a possibility, it's a necessity, because our actions will have, you know, sort of collective effects that we need to deal with as a population.
So Janan, I mean, you're a philosopher of science who really understands the ins and outs of a lot of sciences. Now, economics bothers me because they seem to know a lot about a very complex subject, but it's all based on growth. But growth isn't very good for the world. I mean, growth in economies usually requires growth in population. So is there something about that we can do?
I don't know. I mean, I agree with you. It is a general design problem. And economics is actually built on the model of a kind of self-organizing system. So there it is. The idea is that it's individual actions that will ultimately produce collective effects without any sort of top-down control.
So
I actually don't think economics is likely to be the place to look.
Okay, so Jen, and I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been really great having you and having your insights, and we hope to have you back on Philosophy Talk at greater length sometime.
Can I say one more thing? Which is, I didn't want to just say congratulations on your 200th episode, but thank you. I mean, it's very important, I think, that you make something, philosophy, something more than academic discipline. So I couldn't appreciate more what you do.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Janan.
And we've got another caller in the line now. This is Michael Lipsy from somewhere in the Bay Area. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Michael.
Hello. I love your program. I'm going to have to respectfully disagree with the premise that philosophy has new problems to address because of science and technology, because I think the basic problem of how to live never changes. It's the same now as it was several thousand years ago.
You think life in the 21st century is the same as it was for, I don't know, an ancient Greek or an ancient Egyptian, and that we're faced with exactly the same problems in exactly the same form?
Life is not the same in that we could genetically modify ourselves and.
Whoops!
I think we just lost Michael.
Well, I think Michael makes a good point, though. I'm a little more sympathetic, maybe, with his point than you are, Ken. I mean, you know, we have the problem of neuroscience is telling us all sorts of things about the brain, but already the Greeks were able to kind of look forward to the possibility that the universe was just molecules dropping through the void and occasionally bumping into each other and what that would mean for human personality. So, yeah, everything takes on a different form, but in a way the continuity of philosophical problems speaks very well of philosophers over history and the way they were able to...
I agree. As we said at the opening, many of the problems of philosophy are age-old, perennial problems. But I do think they take on a new form as human life reconfigures itself. I mean, there wasn't the corporation. There wasn't the corporation back in ancient Greece as a person. And then we invented this thing called the corporation, and it had all kinds of social, political, ethical, moral consequences that we needed to develop some new concepts to deal with. And as Janan Ismail was saying to us with our first call, we need to develop new concepts to deal with this massive coordination that was not possible, was not a problem for earlier generations.
You know, Ken, I think a lot of what good philosophy's job is to undermine bad philosophy. So, in a way, it's more likely that a philosopher is going to find some holes in ideas that have just come out of nowhere than come up with something. So corporations is a good example. We idolize a corporation. There's Ayn Randism. There's libertarianism. And one thing philosophy has to do is to get underneath all of that hoopla about
definitely.
Corporations.
And we love the help from our listeners. 1-800-525-9917. We're compiling a top 10 list of what are the most pressing philosophical problems of the 21st century. We've got a caller on the line now. That's Janusz in Berkeley. Welcome to Philosophy, Janusz.
Yes, the issue that I'm concerned about is, you know, laws about capital punishment and laws of morality, you know, that come from the state. It's like there might be people that deserve to die or deserve to be tortured or because of how they look, they shouldn't be on the street, you know, like pornographic or whatever else. But for the law, for the state to make laws about it, to me is very dangerous and goes into a fascism.
So you think that the modern state... Is this possibly, let me see if I've got you right, is this possibly oppressive thing? And we need to, like, think down to the foundations of the modern state and figure out how it works and what justifies it? Is that it?
It shouldn't be through the law. The law should be there to maintain things, to keep things on an even keel. But it shouldn't say you have to kill that killer or, you know, you can't wear something that you're wearing. You know, because it has meaning to you. Education would be a better way to approach that.
So one
can learn a lot from serial killers, you know, to see how to stop the problem. So I think that, you know, philosophically, this is, an issue, you know, that others have dealt with.
Well, I kind of agree with one thing that's implicit in what you're saying about serial killers. Right. I think we've seen a lot of progress in the last 30 years on the whole issue of consciousness about women, women's equality, how a lot of society is based on the way men like things and not very responsive to the way women like things, so forth and so on. But I think we need to take another step and look at men, and particularly boys. We end up with a lot of screwed up men because we don't pay attention to the education and fostering of boys, and most of these serial killers probably could have been identified as having one screw loose or a potential screw loose or being in danger early in life and something might have been done. On the issue of capital punishment, sounds like you think capital punishment is justified in some sense. People deserve to die, but you think the state should not be allowed to take human life. Is that your view? Whoops, you're gone.
I think we've lost Janusz. Our callers are dropping off here.
Yeah,
we've got another caller on the line, John in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, John. What's your comment or question? What do you want to nominate for our top 10?
Is that one of the most important things that philosophy has to address in the 21st century is the issue of truth in the information age, because it seems like so many of the problems that we have, or, you know, certainly recently have faced, are so much tied into the fact of misinformation, and, you know, the lead up to wars and the people saying that global warming is not a problem, and here's all this, you know, data which is most likely false, saying, you know, that it's not a problem. So how do we deal with that, and how do we deal with freedom of speech versus the obligation to speak the truth, and just that whole nature of the realm of information and misinformation.
John, I think you've got a really important point, and it actually goes to something deep about the times we live in. Again, something that didn't face the ancients or the medievals or the early modern philosophers in the 18th, 19th century. We've got this massive ability to disseminate, manipulate, control information. And here I am, just an individual consumer of this stuff. And what am I to trust, and who am I to trust, and why? I mean, the sort of, let's use a fancy philosophy, the epistemic situation of the individual thinker in this global information age is a mess, philosophically speaking. Don't you think, John?
In a way, there's an interesting story about how science and technology undermine knowledge. That is, if you think about it, when you know something, it's usually because that information has been delivered to you by a system that is kind of just reliable, not because you've necessarily checked all the evidence and so forth, but you can just trust certain systems. Like, we trust perception. Sometimes it goes wrong, but basically we can trust it. But look at the things you can't trust anymore. You can't trust photographs because they can be doctored. Used to be, if you saw a photograph of somebody doing something, you were pretty confident that person did it. But now that person's head could have been put on somebody else's body. We think fingerprints are pretty reliable, but probably with human skin grafting and plastic surgery, science will destroy their reliability. So there's a negative epistemic consequence to science and technology that we need to take account of.
Thanks for the call, John. We've got another caller in line. That's Clem in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Clem.
Well, thank you. You know, I think underlying everything in this is the current destruction of all belief.
Tell me what you mean by that, Clem.
By that I mean there has always been something to believe in, and people now truly realize, but they're really underground almost, that, you know, there is nothing. Let's just take the idea that there's no heaven, there's no hell. When you die, it's like going to sleep, and you don't dream, and you don't know it, and that's the end of it. And there always was something to be able to promise people. I mean, look at what's going on in the fundamental world in the Far East. Why are those people fighting so hard? They want to still be able to believe in Allah or whoever. And what are the Christians doing? And who do they want to believe in? They want to have something. All we really do want to realize, however, I think, and I explored it in the book I've written called The Future of Consciousness, is we want to be remembered. But what we want to be remembered for is not our accomplishments, it's our emotion. And there's no way to put that into context any
Clem,
longer.
Clem, I think you're really on to something important there. The kind of loss of meaning has been a problem for the last couple of centuries, but it seems to be getting worse. Everybody likes to think that they're special, and if they're not special, at least their group is special. And if their group isn't special, at least their nation is special. And if their nation isn't special, at least humanity is special. But we keep undermining that feeling. The one philosopher I think is really grappling with that is Dan Dennett. Dan loves science. He loves the starry heavens. He loves the evolution. And he thinks that somehow all of our sense of meaning can still be recovered. I hope he's right.
Yeah, but it's a daunting, daunting thing, Clem. You've asked a really daunting question. Thanks for the call. We're joined now by a man who has his finger in the pulse of just about everything having to do with philosophy. That's Brian Leiter. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago, where he serves as the founding director of the Center for Law, Philosophy, and Human Values. He's a world-renowned Nietzsche scholar and author of the widely influential blog, Leiter Reports. Brian, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks very much for having me again.
Brian, good to talk to you again. Now, I suppose at the top of your list is getting the interpretation of Nietzsche right. But putting that aside, there must be some other important problems. You've just edited a book called The Future of Philosophy, so you must have thought a lot about them. So what is the single most pressing issue for philosophy and philosophers to tackle in the 21st century?
Well, I'm gonna give you a very philosophical answer here.
Oh, God.
You know, the difficulty with answering a question like that is that the figuring out what the future of philosophy is going to be is a little bit like figuring out what the future of science, history, culture is going to be, since philosophy throughout its history has always reacted to developments in the world around it. You know, if it happens in the next 50 years that we can produce, designer babies with just the genes we want them to have, that's going to generate almost inevitably a set of philosophical views, questions, literatures, and so on. So since my crystal ball about the future of science, history, and culture isn't that good, I'm not sure about...
Brian, I ask you to put you in the position of that guy you study a lot, Nietzsche, who was a great cultural critic and saw the death of European culture and was trying to call forth a new culture. I mean, I want you to call forth the new philosophers from your own perspective to say, what new philosophers should you be thinking about?
Brian, let me give you a little device to help you think.
Okay.
So let's suppose that Obama establishes a national endowment for philosophy, and he appoints you as director. And your first job is to say, well, you're going to give me $100 million, but only when I come up with a plan for the three areas I'd most like to impact in the next 15 years. What would they be and why?
Ah, okay. Well, that's a good prompt. I actually think that philosophy in the next 100 years is going to be occupied with some very general topics it's been occupied with for 2,500 years. That is, I think the objectivity of truth, knowledge, morality have been central questions throughout the history of philosophy, and they're going to continue to be. The things that got Plato so exercised about the sophists and the pre-Socratics are in different ways issues that get people exercised in the present and are going to get people exercised in the future. So in that regard, I don't think philosophy's future is going to be entirely different.
But Brian, I'm going to ask you to stay on for a minute. We have a break coming up, but I want you to think about this. You say truth about the truth of morality and all that. I want to ask you why you think we still need to be seized with that question. Why aren't those settled questions? But I'll remind our listeners, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're celebrating 200 episodes by gathering suggestions for the most challenging philosophical issues facing us in the 21st century.
The state of the earth. Our obligations to one another, the nature of the nation, corporations, the human mind, freedom of the will. The 21st century is going to offer plenty for philosophers to chew on. But what are the most pressing issues for us to address? Tell us what you think. The number to call is 1-800-525-9917. Or send us an email to comments@philosophytalk.org. Or share your thoughts with the world and with posterity by contributing to our blog at theblog.philosophytalk.org.
We'll get to more suggestions for our philosophical top 10 list when Philosophy Talk continues.
The world is changing, and philosophers can't sit around and wait. They must change with it. But what are the most important changes we face? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk Radio that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're compiling a philosophical top 10 list as part of our 200th episode celebration.
Tell us what you think. The number to call is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or email us, and we're getting a lot of emails, and I'm trying to monitor them so that we can get the suggestions on our list. Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Or make a contribution to our blog where we can have an ongoing conversation that we can even share with posterity. We've still got Brian Leiter from the University of Chicago on the line. And Brian, I want to ask, you said... One of the things you said that intrigued me, you said philosophers will be seized with things they've been seized with in the past. One of the things was about truth and the objectivity of moral values and all that. Why are those still open questions? Why isn't that settled?
This is one of these hard questions about philosophy, of course, which is that philosophers tend not to settle things.
Don't you think it's more than that? Don't you think there's something about our culture that has lost confidence? And not just philosophers, but cultural agents of all sorts that have lost confidence in the objectivity of truth and moral value and all that?
I don't know about that. I mean, let's just take the objectivity of moral values. You know, if you go back to antiquity, right, the Greeks were appalled when they discovered that the Egyptians were eating their dead. And this raised the question about the possible relativity of values. And now you fast forward 2,500 years in the era of so-called right globalization, and of course we're confronted. There's really two phenomena. We're confronted again, with all kinds of variations in human practices, right, that raise this same question. How could those people do that? How could those people believe that when certain things seem so obvious to us? But the flip side, of course, is that with the spread of capitalism around the globe, we are seeing more homogenization in cultural practices. And I suppose, I mean, this, now here's an interesting question. if that trend continues over the next, 100 or 200 years, then I suppose there's a danger that some of the pressure for these sorts of questions is going to evaporate.
Right.
But not because we solved the philosophical problem, but because forces beyond our control produce a kind of complacency, don't throw up the counterexamples to what we take for granted.
Well, right, and that's a danger of reflective intelligence, that, you know, these globalizing structures could just stamp out, extinguish all variation, and some of us think that wouldn't be a good thing. But, you know, on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us, Brian. Thanks for your insight.
Thank you, and thank you for this show.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian.
So, John, I think you have a lot. Have you gathered a lot of emails and data that you'd like to share with us, from input from people over the internet?
Well, the overpopulation issue is interesting to some. Kevin says, why is it considered so terrible to limit ourselves in some ways, such as only having one child per family, or monitoring the amount of resources we use? So that's one of the big contenders, is all the philosophical issues connected with ecology and overpopulation. Some of the writers emphasize perennial problems, but one who doesn't perhaps is Ron, who says perhaps you should do a show on public education. It will be a 21st century battleground. And I think he's got a good point there. It's a battleground in California. As budgets grow lean, our dedication to equal education for all, or at least a good minimum education for all, seems to be weakening just when it should be strengthening.
Well, there's also this cultural pluralism, right? I mean, the world, despite what Brian Leiter says, there are these homogenizing tendencies, but there are also these fracturing tendencies. And when you have fractured people in a fractured nation who don't have a shared culture and a shared conception of how things ought to be, public education is bound to be a battleground, because it's trying to figure out what ought we all to believe in common, and right, and whether it's the right of some central authority to enforce such commonality. But now we're joined by another past guest who holds the record still for appearances on Philosophy Talk. That's Martha Nussbaum. She's professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago. She's a prolific writer and very engaged public intellectual. She has a forthcoming book, From Disgust to Humanity, Sexual Orientation and Constitutional Law. Martha, welcome back to Philosophy Talk. It's been a while.
Yes, hi. It's great to be back on the program, and thank you for this wonderful program.
So, Martha, you not only do great scholarship and technical philosophy, you're also a public intellectual. You write for the New York Review of Books and all sorts of people. And you obviously think a lot about what philosophy can contribute to our shared lives. So, from that perspective, from the perspective of your role as a public intellectual, what is the most important thing that philosophy might bring to the table over the course of the 21st century?
Well, you know, I don't want to deny anything that my colleague Brian said. That is, I think we have to go on working on the permanent problems of philosophy, or we'll lose our edge on the new ones. But I do think that there is something new that we have to do, and that is to really get to work on an adequate theory of global justice. In the 20th century, we've made astonishing progress in the theory of social justice, with the idea that the nation state is the basic unit that's going to distribute things to people. And I think with the work of John Rawls and then the responses to it, even if we don't have an agreement, we have a very well worked out set of alternatives. Feminists have added to it with theories of justice in the family. There's recently been related work on justice for people with disabilities. So we're getting to a very advanced point in the theory of social justice. But, you know, if you look at the nations of the world and what we owe one another across national boundary lines, we're really just in the infancy of that project. And we have to think about what justice is like when there's no overarching state.
I think, Martha, I think you're right. I think this is a deep problem, because in a way we're engaged in a collective task that generations before haven't really been. We have to preserve this earth, and we have to do it in a way that at the time that resources have to be redistributed from rich to poor because these inequalities of nations just aren't sustainable given, you know, the power of the media and global commerce. It's just not sustainable. And I think we're I think we're a little bit at sea on this issue.
I think we are, because we still think that justice requires an overarching state. And, you know, in the past there's been theory of justice in war, and that's been worked out. But the theory of basic day-to-day justice, when we're joining one another in lots of ways, but not through a state, we don't really understand yet what that is. What's the job of multinational corporations? What's the job of each individual to conserve resources? And, you know, it's got to be a multidisciplinary project. Philosophers can't do it alone, because we have to include a theory of environmental justice, a theory of sustainability and justice for future generations. So all of those things require scientific expertise, require knowledge of how corporations work. So we've got to also reach out to other disciplines if we're going to do this right.
So one place where that issue is coming up daily in America is immigration. And I've done some thinking about that. We've done a show on it. And there's just not a lot of deep thinking out there. I mean, when you ask yourself, why should somebody standing on one side of the Rio Grande who has a chance for a job and money on the other side, what exactly is the nature of anybody having the right to forbid him to do that? If you add that, maybe what's going to happen when some of these people that want to immigrate are coming from places that have been destroyed by global warming caused by the places they want to immigrate to, there's just a whole lot of issues, and I don't think philosophers have given us the machinery to think about it.
No, I think that we kind of think that being born in a given nation is just as morally irrelevant as being born in a given race or a given gender. There shouldn't be a basis for differential life chances, but we really haven't thought about what we want to say about that. And, you know, we can't avoid it anymore. I mean, I think at one point we could say, oh, well, we just, our lives don't touch the lives of people on the other side of the world. But now, of course, every day they do.
Yeah.
Every consumer purchase we make basically influences lives on the other side of the world.
On that note, Martha, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been really great. We've got to have you back for a full hour sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, thanks so much.
Thanks, Martha.
Wonderful show.
We've got time for one last quick caller. That's Greg in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Greg.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, I think that one central vital issue for philosophy would be the mind-body problem, which I think is still, to a great degree, a fundamental contradiction in our way of looking at the world. It involves issues of individuality versus membership in the universe, so to speak. It involves truth. How do you determine truth? If can we determine truth if we are so separate from what is around us?
I think that's a very good point, Greg. In my mind, there's always been these three problems: the mind-body problem, the free will problem, and the nature of time, that just connect with all the philosophical problems and the way we live, and they're deep. And science isn't making them easier; they're making them harder.
Yeah. So thanks for the call. That, I think this is a really important one. Science is really giving us a tough time with the mind-body problem. So I want to thank all of you who contributed to our philosophical top 10 list, and we're going to see if we can have a little rundown of the top 10 things generated by it. So take it away, John.
Well, number 10, this is based on what our listeners have said and what we think. Number 10, the 10th most important philosophical problem of the 21st century, the need for common sensibility, a new culture in this age where belief is absence, and dealing with the relativization of values. Number 9, social identification. Number 8, the human mind. What is consciousness? Number 7, capital punishment, especially in the light of neuroscience research on the freedom of human action. Why don't you give us number 6, Ken?
Number 6, navigating the tension between freedom of communication and misinformation. That's a really good one.
And now for the fifth most important,
private property in a globalized world and the future of intellectual property. Number four, collective decisions and collective rationality. We need new models, no doubt about it. Number three, the nature of the human individual in light of upcoming scientific developments, designer babies, cloning, and all that sort of stuff. Number two, human relationships with the environment and resource conservation. That's a big one. And the number one most important pressing issue of the 21st century for philosophers to consider, artificial intelligence, because we're going to be able to create new minds, and they're going to be some weird minds at that. So, John, you got any closing thoughts about
this? Well, of course, then there's the overarching issue that engulfs and all of these, which is funding for philosophy on public radio.
Yeah, there you go.
There's a problem that the culture needs to solve.
Well, I mean, one of the things for a challenge for philosophers in the 21st century is to take philosophy out of the ivy tower and into the public, because I believe that the public needs philosophy. But, you know, on that note, I'll say that this conversation will continue on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. And we've got this ongoing conversation there that will keep going, and you contribute to it. Or check out our Facebook page. It's really growing in leaps and bounds.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. Now, for the final word on our 200th episode, we turn to someone who makes his lists in a hurry and reads them in a hurry, but he thinks them through very, very carefully. I'm talking about Ian Scholes, who's been with us from the beginning of Philosophy Talk. Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, we stand here on this anniversary of Philosophy Talk, or sit here in some cases in comfortable chairs, to address the philosophical challenges of the 21st century. But let's get some context here. Where did we stand, great ideas-wise, a century ago? Well, Darwinism hit the world big time in the late 19th century, but by the time the 20th rolled around, the big idea of evolution had trickled down to dinky old social Darwinism, based on the notion that some people are more fit to live than others, and who better than society's elite to decide who those people are. Freudianism gave psychotherapy to rich folks who could afford it, but ended the century as a subplot in Woody Allen movies. Marxism came into its own, kind of, in the 20th century. Capitalism kept refusing to crumble, however, which led to some desperate dream logic in the Soviet Union, among them the embrace of Lysenkoism. Lysenko being Stalin's director of the Soviet Lenin All-Union Institute of Agricultural Sciences, who eventually concluded that class revolution was occurring on a molecular level. Turns out, it wasn't. Parallel to the world of ideas, the airplane was invented, electricity flourished, the telephone installed, radio and record players, the car, which gave rise to Henry Ford's one big idea, more of a notion, really, of the assembly line, which made workers both more efficient and more justified in hating their jobs, which helped lead to the rise of Marxism and Nazis. Einstein's big idea of relativity trickled down to the popular notion that everything is relative. Moral and cultural relativity led to large-scale acting out, which led to the Jazz Age, Expressionism, Surrealism, Existentialism, and the subsequent disenfranchisement of the bourgeoisie, Prohibition, fear of communism, and the rise of the Nazis, who further trickled down social Darwinism into mass murder. Communism, on the other hand, only killed those who displayed false consciousness. That turned out to be a lot of people as well. Disenfranchisement, along with alienation, are 20th century notions. Oh, and the atomic bomb, which is where the rubber of trickle-down Einstein met the road and reduced both rubber and road to rubble. Besides vague and nameless fears, the 20th century also gave us the Ponzi scheme, styrofoam, and leaf blowers, all of which are evil, relatively. The 21st century is still young, but it has already given us the ShamWow, the Snuggie, and the beer holster, a truly fine invention that allows users to carry alcoholic beverages on their hips. It doesn't quite measure up to the invention of the Model T Ford or the gramophone, but hey, it's the 21st century. We'll take what we can get and then go on Twitter to chat about it, where great thoughts will, no doubt, eventually arise. I gotta go.
The Wisdom of the Ages, in a nutshell, from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2009.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation. Also, from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.